takes me where the promise
My name is Alex, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday ATM Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the Navit Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aablueshipspeakers.org will hear our speakers, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight's speaker is Blue Chip's very own Tim, who has been a wonderful presence in my life. And the way he welcomes people into this meeting specifically is something I very much admire. And I am very excited to hear his story.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks, everybody, for being here tonight. Well, I'm Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's April 30th, 2007, and my birthday is December 30th, 1953. Thank you. That makes me 71. I've got 17 years since my last drink. Justin. 71, and you flip it over, you got 17. I feel like a spiritual teenager, so I guess I am. Still got 18, 19, and then I'll be an old timer when I'm 20, if I make it, because I can only do this one day at a time. We've got a website,
aablueshipspeakers.org.
Our speaker meeting, we go a little overboard. We record our speakers, and with their permission, we put them online. We've been doing that for a while. When we started doing it with the NavaClub.org website, and pretty soon we were dominating the homepage. So there was a little bit of wrangling and wrestling going. A lady named Donna P., who created our website for us. And if you haven't visited, it's really beautiful, easy to navigate. And right now we have over 800 recordings that go back to about 2008. Now this meeting predates that by a long shot. My sponsor, Tim Moore, he's been in the meeting longer than I have, by several years. But I had my first AA meeting here. I picked up a white chip that night at this meeting, and I'll talk about that a little bit later on. But as I said, my sponsor is Tim Moore. His sponsor is Ken Horvat, a longtime member of 6:15 a.m. Dawn Busters group at 8111. And he's now recently settled with his wife on Hilton Head Island, which is an old haunt of mine. Back then in my early 20s, I made history, not necessarily the kind of history that I should talk about too much, but he's there rectifying some of my wrongs, I hope. His sponsor was a guy named Papa Bill. When I came into the program, I was 53 years old, and I thought I was over the hill and I was shot. If you looked at my medical chart, you would have said he didn't have much longer. Papa Bill, he got his first AA meeting and picked up a white chip when he was in his 60s, or right at 60. And he lived to be in his 90s. and he sponsored thousands of guys. And I had to sponsor thousands of guys. He was a real inspiration. I had a little hope after that. And one day Tim said, we need to go see Papa Bill at 8111 so you can meet him. That's your great band sponsor. And when I walked in, it was like Yoda. You know, he just, you know, he was glowing and he was just floating there on above his chair. And I walked up to him and I was introduced to him. And he goes, well, welcome to AA, Tim. Are you happy, joyous, and free? And I said, no one's asked me that before. And I said, well, not yet. But you know, I really want to be. And he said, well, just hang in there. Stick with your sponsor and work these steps. And I promise you, you will be happy, joyous, and free. And Papa Bill was right. I'm going to pause for a second and just say a little prayer to try to collect myself, try to get on in the right spirit of things. God, please direct our thinking tonight so that those thoughts are divorced of self-pity, dishonesty, self-will, self-seeking, and fear. God, inspire our thinking, decisions, and intuitions. Help us to relax and take it easy. Free us from doubt and indecision. Guide us and show us our next step. God, please help me find the words to better express our will. Ask all these things and I be of maximum service to you and our fellows. In the name of the steps, the powerfully loving way of life, I pray. Amen.
Amen.
I also say amen a lot. I was an Air Force brat born in a town called Bourne, next to Otis Air Force Base on the Cape. In Massachusetts. I was born in Massachusetts. Most of the time, I guess I was raised in the South, but my family being Air Force family, we traveled all over in the beginning, early ages, and ended up in Taegu, Korea, and our last station was in Tokyo, where unfortunately my father, he was a jet pilot, had a fatal air crash. I think I was 6 and a half, and my sister Pam, it was the day before her third birthday. So that was tough, real tough. But he was a bigger-than-life character and certainly had shoes that were difficult to fill. He was an all-SEC tight end at Auburn. His senior year, he played under Shug Jordan, who was a legendary coach that had a good run of it in the 50s and early 60s. Vince Dooley was a quarterback who was a freshman when he was a senior. Vince was a family friend going forward, and he kind of reached out because he knew my dad had died. And Vince was a member of the military. He was a vet also. When we were in Columbus, Georgia, I always knew he was there, and I opened the door, and the house smelled like pipe tobacco. He was a real positive influence, even though I was going to find myself smoking at an early age. In third grade, I was smoking rabbit tobacco with the friends out, you know, around the campfire. Columbus, we were always out in the woods, swimming in the creeks. So I started sneaking cigarettes from my mother's cigarette pack. There were Parliament with recessed filters, and I felt so sophisticated at 8 years old, puffing on these things. My friend, you know, would pass it around, and my friends would, like, hardly do anything, and I was, taking deep inhales from the get-go. And they're going, well, you better watch out, you're going to get addicted. I was like, no, I don't think so. And they were right, and by the time I was in fourth grade, I was a pack-a-day smoker. And I was having to sneak around. It was like, you know, a fourth grade secret agent, lying and cheating and stealing. You had to get the cigarettes somehow. And I was pretty good at getting them. And I fed that habit. And later on, I was in junior high, all through elementary, I played sports. I was the biggest kid in the class. But I would have my, like, crush-proof Marlboros and my shoulder pads at football practice, sneak out in the woods and smoke a cigarette, you know, before and after practice. All the adults smoked back then, so, you know, it seemed like they did. But nobody ever confronted me, ever. You know, those are character defects that were developed at an early age. And I really, well, when I came to my first AA meeting and I picked up a chip and they read how it works, I was going, rigorous honesty? What's that? I thought I was going to be one of those types. But, you know, I found that if you come into the room and you just keep coming back one day at a time, things start progressing. And there's hope for all of us. It's a program of second chances. So my mother was a widow. My sister and I had a couple of stepfathers. Well, before I get to that, my father had a military, you know, military honors, 21-gun salute at Vicksburg at the National Cemetery down there. Flyover, seven jet flyover, somewhere in there's a missing man or something, but I was like 6 years old. I didn't process at all. But I had an uncle who was 14 at the time. The service was over. He put his arm around me and he said, Tim, you're now the man of the house. That kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. I was 6 years old. I didn't know what to do with that. And that kind of led me into the, you know, wanting to get out of my feelings when the cigarettes early, deep inhaling and doing all that, and before I could get into alcohol. And but, you know, we had alcohol around the house. My second stepfather kept a well-stocked bar. My mother, well, we had an uncle that was a severe alcoholic, and he would go on binges. He'd go 3 months without a drink. And he was the greatest, sweetest man in the world. And then he'd go on a binge, and he would just, he smelled like a goat. We'd pick him up to the drunk tanks. I would ride in the car, and we'd put him in the back seat. And we had to fumigate the car when we'd pick him up. And my mother said, we're going to teach our children to drink like ladies and gentlemen. So she would get the crystal out in the china, and then we'd have a big family dinner. And we had white wine and certain courses, red wine, certain courses. And we had after dinner liqueurs. And we're just kids being trained to drink like ladies and gentlemen. It didn't taste that good to me, so I didn't, you know, I just sip on it. I volunteered to clear the table, and I would take all those half full glasses and pour them into a Slurpee cup, put a little Kool-Aid on top of it, and ice it down, take it back to my bedroom, and whirl out, spinning on the bed. That's the way I did it. And we didn't do it all the time. I wasn't an alcoholic right away, but I had alcoholic behavior always. And after this Vicksburg Cemetery, we would go to my grandparents. My grandparents, he was secretary of the Methodist Church in Mississippi, got his PhD in theology at Vanderbilt, and he was quite a gentleman. And he was also very handy as a carpenter, and he built a tree house in the backyard. And this tree house was like right out of Leave It to Beaver or some family sitcom. And it was just so great. And I was the oldest grandchild, so basically I broke it in for everybody. They let us watch Gunsmoke one night. We didn't get a chance to watch much TV. We get sent to bed early. They had this guy, they put a noose around his neck and they hung him, and it looked real. Yeah, so it was some stuntman did it, and they had all the props to do it. But I'm like 7 years old going, how did they do that? And I went to my grandfather's workshop, and there was a rope that just was perfect for tying a noose. So I made a noose, and then I set the ropes where it was up under my arms, and I had the noose coming up out of my t-shirt, and I tied it to a limb at the treehouse, and I was just hanging there, entertaining myself. And my grandmother came out to tell me it was time for lunch, and she went down. She hit the floor, fainted, dead away. My father just died. And, you know, she just, her first impression was this kid just off himself. And I'm like, grandmother, grandmother. And she's out. So I go get a little dish towel, and I'm patting her face with it. She comes to, and she looks at me, and she grabbed me, and she wore my ass out. And I deserved it. But I was the loose cannon of the Ridgeway family after that. Every time we would come there, she'd go on edge. She'd go, what's she going to do next? The poor lady, I traumatized her for the rest of her life. Somehow, she came to Atlanta in her nursing home years, and I'd go visit her. I was living in Ansley Park at the time. And she would just like, what are you going to do? Instead of comforting her, she was like terrified that I was going to do something just horrible. I tried to be a good grandson at the end, and I guess I was. Our relationship was always strained. So after my mother married her second husband, second stepfather for me and my sister, I was at Sandy Springs High School, and already I figured out that I could buy a bag of pot, you know, a $20 bag of pot, and I could make a couple of nickel bags and end up with a dime bag and somehow end up with free pot. Started out simple, and when I was 53 years old, I was still doing stuff like that. I mean, I never grew up. I was just, my maturity stopped when I was like 8 years old, when I started smoking. And when I started drinking, I really regressed. So, you know, I had a dragster in high school, and there was another tree house in my story. High school girlfriend, her little brother was like 12 years old, and I was his bootlegger and dope dealer for him and his little friends. And they had a tree house, and that's where I would meet him on Friday nights. God bless him, he financed our romance. I had a lot more pocket money for dates than I would have if I didn't do that. And he comes up later in the story when AA comes into the picture. Went to University of Georgia, somehow got in. I did well on, always do good on tests. Somehow, I don't know why. I didn't put a lot of effort into things. And then once I got to UGA, I discovered there are things called black beauties, red and blacks, and you stay up all night the night before an exam or essay. And somehow I graduated with honors, and it wasn't because of hard work. I heard somewhere that if you study while you're drinking, you better be drinking when you go take the test. On the same plane, so I was solid. I got a buzz on all the time starting then, because back then the drinking age was 18. So I went to college at 17, December 30th, came 18, January 1st. All of a sudden I had my first legal driver's license. Before that I always had a fake ID. I could always get whatever I wanted to get, but now I didn't have to sweat about which ID to give to the cops when they pull me over. I went to Hilton Head. I met my wife. Well, she became my ex-wife, the mother of my son, who just celebrated December 5th, his 46th birthday. So a lot of water under the bridge there. After resettling back into Atlanta with my son was born, I decided, I'm just getting nowhere. I got this journalism degree, and I'm working for these newspapers, and I'm a photographer and a reporter, and I'm working 60 hours a week, little paycheck. So I might as well go in the military. And then I started thinking about it. I said, I want to be a jet pilot like my dad. I go in, I see this recruiter, and I'm 26 years old. And you got to do this before you're 27, before you're 28. The guy goes, you got a degree? I said, yeah. He said, what's it in? I said, journalism. Air Force doesn't really need a lot of journalists. I said, well, I'm going to be a jet pilot. And he's going, oh, you are? I said, yeah. And he says, do you have any DUIs? And I said, only two. Poor guy. He goes, there's no way. There is absolutely no way. I said, what if I got some letters of recommendation? I said, it better be damn good letters of recommendation. So I said, well, let me see what I can do. So when I was at UGA, I was in a fraternity, and my stepfather was friends with Senator Herman Talmadge. And Talmadge was a brother in the fraternity that I placed with. So he sent me a letter on United States Senate letterhead, welcoming me. He said, if there's anything I can ever do for you, don't hesitate to ask. So here it is. I need a letter of recommendation to get in the Air Force. So I sent him a copy of the letter he sent me with a letter asking him for a letter of reference. And boom, I mean, a week later, here it comes. I got this letter, golden boss letter, from one of our senators. Now, our other senator was chairman of the Armed Forces Committee at the time. So I took the letter that he sent me, recommending me, and I sent him a copy to the other senator. And lo and behold, in just a few days, I had another letter from two Georgia senators. Jimmy Carter, who just passed away yesterday, 100 years old. God bless his soul. He's just been elected president. So I took their letters and sent it to the White House. Boom. And that was a big letterhead. I mean, big old golden boss. Presidential seal. You know, I don't even need to think about how inappropriate that was. You know, as far as my father's memory, I mean, I can just see his spirit going, oh my God, don't do this. But, you know, I wanted what I wanted, and I wanted it now. And I took those letters into the recruiter, and he said, you're the guy with the DUIs, right? I said, yeah, but I told you I'd get some letters. He said, let me see them. I laid them out. He looked at me and goes, oh, my God. And I feel terrible today what I put that guy through. And he goes, well, let me see what my spirit is saying. And he took the letters and put them in a file, and he called me back up, and he said, okay, you got a green light if you can pass all the other tests, but you'll have to pass them. We're not giving, you know, you're not just getting in. We'll accept you for OCS, put you in flight training. If you can do it. Now, I'm drinking like a fish. It's just a fantasy, really. But I told everybody. I was working at a place called Andy's Sport Car Center, sold Jaguars, British Leyland products, Lotus Esprits, all these fancy English sport cars. I told them I'm going to be a jet pilot. And they're like, well, good luck. Awesome. You know, they gave me a going away party and all this. And I go down to Warner Robins. I passed every test. I could read maps. I did all the stuff. Then they gave me an eye test. They said, well, you got 20/20 vision. I said, well, let's try. We have one more eye test. It was testing for astigmatism. And I'm still like, when you go, you get your driver's license and what side, you know, the lights are flashing. I flunked it. I said, wait, I didn't understand the instructions. Give it to me again. So I did exact opposite of what I actually saw. And he goes, wow, that's incredible. And so then he said, well, let's give you a third test. And then he mixed it up, did a little switcheroo, and I flunked it again. And he goes, you're a lying. Well, that's what I do. I lie. He said, listen, there's no way you're going to fly a jet. You're not going to get in one of these jets. You'll never be able to land on an Air Force, on a Navy aircraft carrier. I'm like, this is Air Force. I'm not worried about that. Well, listen, you're just not going to be able to do it. We're not going to trust you with a high-performance, multi-million-dollar aircraft with weaponry that you could wipe out half of Georgia. Well, if you're not going to let me do that, I'm just not going to do it. And he's going, oh, no, you could be a navigator. You could be, you could fly as a co-pilot. You get your certification and go to work for, whatever. You can fly, but you're not going to fly jets. And then the alcoholism kicked in, and I'm like, am I really going to stop drinking and go to boot camp and then go to OCS and then have to wait like 3 months between drinks and just do the right thing? No, I'm not. I went straight to the package store, and I didn't have a cell phone or anything because they didn't have them. And I didn't call my wife. And by the time I got home, I'm knee walking drunk. And I just put the key in the door and walk in. Honey, I'm home. And she's like, what are you doing here? She was expecting me in 6 months. And I said, I decided not to do this. Poor lady. It's a good thing, because if I had gotten in there and blew it with all those letters, that would have been terrible. You know, I found myself about 52 years old. We had a member of the family that had an intervention, went to Ridgeview. I figured I was a lot worse case than she was. They're coming for me next. That Thanksgiving, I just went cold turkey, and I got on my knees and I asked God for the strength not to drink. I made it one day at a time, and I didn't have any knowledge of the doctor's opinion or the AA, the big book or anything. So after about a month of that, the cravings went away, and I started telling myself I had willpower and stopped praying to God, all ego. And then after a year, on Thanksgiving, I go to family Thanksgiving, and I got a one-year AA medallion without ever going to an AA meeting. It was a real nice gesture from the family, and it was very supportive. But I really didn't know what to do with that, because I knew I had never been to an AA meeting. And I didn't understand the significance of the medallion. And anyway, things went haywire with our mother. She had fallen and broken her hip, and she had strokes, and she was going through a long process of dying. And so when, I started romancing, a glass of red wine, and I was just going to go to have a nice dinner and have a glass of red wine like a gentleman. And that worked out great. I didn't even finish the glass of wine. I had a cup of coffee, before I finished the wine, and I said, "You did it." And I was congratulating myself, but all I thought about was, when am I going to have the next glass of red wine? I could see it falling around. And I put it on the calendar, and I waited, you know, like 6 or 7 days. And finally, do this thing, and I get this wine, and that time, I just slugged it like a shooter. And then the next day, I just went to the package store and restocked up. And then I didn't stop drinking for months. And then I was living at the lake house. My sister has a lake house in Gainesville. And she comes by and says, "Hey, how you doing?" And I said, "Not good." So, "What do you mean?" "So I can't stop drinking." She goes, "We gave you an AA medallion. We thought you quit drinking." I said, "Well, I did for a while, but I've been sneaking around. I'm good at sneaking around." She goes, "Well, what do you want to do about it?" I said, "I don't know. What do you think I would do about it?" She goes, "I know exactly what we're going to do about it. Just pack a bag." And it was a Monday, and they drove me here to this room. And the guy who's telling his story was 12 years sober. I recognized him when he started talking about the treehouse in Sandy Springs and his big sister's boyfriend. We got him started down this road. And I'm sitting out there for my very first AA meeting, and I'm like, "Oh, well, what do I need to do?" And they offered me a white chip, and I said, "I better get it." And so at that point, I became willing to just stand up and pick up the white chip. That night I met Tim, and he got me a big book out of the literature cabinet, and he gave me a little advice. He said, "Listen, don't complicate it, keep it simple. When you get home, get on your knees, ask your higher power for the strength not to drink. And then when you finish that prayer, climb into bed, open up the big book, and start reading from the front cover, and read until you fall asleep." I made it one paragraph. It's the first night I'd not drunken myself into oblivion in months. I woke up that morning without a hangover, without cotton mouth. I got on my knees. "Thank you, higher power. Oh my gosh." And then I've been at Napa the night before and came back to Napa that next day. I believe that's what happened. To be honest, I don't know what the hell happened that first week. I had DTs rolling around the carpet, and if it hadn't been for Pam grabbing me and just holding me down, I would have gone through a ceiling or something. It was, you know, I never just cut it off that, you know, that quickly before. But I hadn't been drinking like that before. But my liver was like a set of old ball tires. It was worn out, and I needed a fresh liver. Never got a fresh liver. They put me on the list there for a while. I healed up. But then I found out I had cancer. They told me it was stage 4 colon cancer, 3 years into sobriety. And they said, "Get your affairs in order." And I said, "Well, I worked the steps. Do I have to do any more than that?" They said, "Well, that's a good start." It just turned out that I just kept doing this thing one day at a time. And I got the world's greatest surgeon. And he gave us an incredible deal. I paid him just a little bit of money every month for several years. But it finally paid for the surgery. But he took out 40% of my colon and all the associated lymph nodes to that section. And I haven't had any repercussions since then. And I took chemo, and about 5 years ago, my oncologist said, I'm not saying you're not going to die of cancer one day, too, but you're not going to die of that cancer. That cancer is gone. And he said, I always do. Being in the cancer business, you lose your patients. They either die or they get well. This is our last appointment. So I gave him a hug and said, God willing, you know, I'm still doing this thing one day at a time. And I hadn't had a drink throughout this whole time. I was going to go through all the steps just to prove it. I got it all here and condensed into one page. And I'm not going to go through that.
We're running out of time.
So like I said,
AA, bluechipspeakers.org.
Now it's about 800 hours of experience, strength, and hope. We've just reserved the YouTube channel name AA Blue Chip Speakers. And we haven't gotten anybody up there yet. But it's coming soon. Live in Gainesville. It's a 55-mile commute to here. So I come down here on Monday nights. And other times, like when we have acoustical coffee houses and things and events and stuff. And I like to help out with that kind of stuff. I'm involved in another home group in Gainesville called the Fresh Air Group. It's at the Halt Club. And I'm a regular attendee of the Sunday 9 a.m. Gainesville Classic Group. If you're ever in Gainesville, call me up and we'll go to a meeting. And if you ever want to tell your story, call me up and we'll put you on the schedule. As Bill Wilson said, when pain comes, we're expected to learn from it willingly. Help others to learn. When happiness comes, we accept it as a gift and thank God for it. And Dr. Bob's Nightmare says, I believe that emotional sobriety is less about the quality of feeling, good or bad, and more about the general ability to feel feelings. Being restored to sanity isn't about getting the brass ring or cash and prizes, or being happy, joyous, and free all the time. But it's about being in the present moment, whatever it happens to look like. What am I experiencing right now? How about now? Can I present to all of my feelings without any one of them defining me? Happiness might be sitting next to regret. Joy might be right next to being overwhelmed. That is just a human condition. And experiencing all of my feelings is true emotional sobriety. Dr. Bob goes on to say, it's the most wonderful blessing to be relieved of the terrible curse with which we are afflicted. For many of us, our health is good, and we regain our self-respect and respect for our colleagues. Our home lives are 12 steps closer to ideal, and our businesses are good as can be expected in these uncertain times. Many of us spend a great deal of time passing on what we have learned to others who want and need it badly. We do it for four reasons. One, sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. Three, because in doing so, we are paying our debt to the man or woman who took time to pass it on to us. Four, because every time we do it, we take out a little more insurance for ourselves against a possible slip. I had a long prayer that we don't have time for. It ends with, help me to walk with faith and acceptance, to see good things in unexpected places and talents and unexpected people, and give me the grace to tell them so. Help me to see that you love each of your children and that you do not need my opinion of them or suggestions on what they might deserve. Thank you very much. Amen.
Thank you, Tim. And I'm sure you'd be happy to share the prayer with anybody who wants to hear it after the meeting.
First I slip, and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. Rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul. folks, they wear the promises all real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window, for a heart that beats for me, takes me where the promises are. See you later.